Welcome to Dig in the Dirt. I'm Ann Goldin, and I have the distinct pleasure today of having Pat Corcoran. He's the OSU Extension Coastal Hazards Expert.
Outreach. Mm-hmm.
Oh, outreach. Yeah,
that's
right.
Okay.
Well, you're
like
all,
this.
You're also the expert. And we are going to talk about a very timely subject, which is preparing for crises of all kind. KMUN is a source for information from lost dogs to road closures and natural and other disasters that we need to be prepared for. So, Pat, what is it that you, what area are you concerned with? What's your reach with your work?
Geographically?
Yes.
The Oregon coast, 362 miles sort of.
No way, the whole thing?
This, on paper, that's the case. In reality, it's Clatsop and Tillamook counties and a little bit in Lincoln, working with colleagues at the Hatfield Marine Science Center. Uh-huh. But I do love Southern Oregon and have colleagues down there, and I try to get down at least a couple times a year, working with a colleague in Curry County in Gold Beach to pick up some of this and do some work down in that part of the state.
So a lot of people are probably familiar with what you do, but just in case there are
sure.
people that don't know, explain what it is that you do. Because I like an extension agent that does hazards, what's that?
Yeah. So the Clatsop County Extension Service is part of the OSU Extension Service. We have OSU offices in most of Oregon's 36 counties. And so I'm an Oregon State University faculty in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. And I'm working here out of the Clatsop County Extension Office. And the job is to, you know, an analogy of the Extension Service is like an extension cord, transferring some of that research power from campus and plugging it into communities that need that research. So my job is to educate folks here on the coast about what the latest research is on various things, from coastal storms and erosion on the chronic side of things, all the way to our Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. So I work with colleagues on what they're doing and talk about how I can visit with, educate, and demonstrate to local people the impacts of that research. So Chris Goldfinger, you know, identifies these core samples of a 10,000-year history of subduction zone earthquakes and tsunamis. My job is to help explain that to people to understand what that means in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and now in that process, a bunch of things have happened. We now have maps, and we got updated maps. And the new maps tell us where it's safe to go and where it's not safe to go anywhere in Clatsop and also
all along
on,
the coast,
including the Long Beach Peninsula.
Sure. Yes. There's been a nationwide mapping project after, and this is the 10-year, I would say commemoration more than a celebratory anniversary mm-hmm. of the 2004 Sumatran earthquake mm-hmm. and the tsunamis that ravaged the Indonesia, mm-hmm. The South Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was 10 years ago.
Wow.
And, you know, I have developed some expertise in the earthquake and tsunami preparedness, mm-hmm. but it all started back on December 26th of 2004. My work here was coastal storms and worrying about the chronic hazards. You know, I think we all looked in horror.
Slides and erosion.
And yes, coastal erosion in different places mm-hmm. Along the coast, landslides and all of those kind of typical storms that we have. And along with everybody else, looked in horror at the images coming from Sumatra and Thailand and around the Indonesian Ocean and thought, my goodness, you know, I have a bachelor's and a master's degree in geography. I sort of know in my brain, you know, about plate tectonics and tsunamis, but, you know, it was much so visceral, you mm-hmm. know, seeing that and the tragedy that I just kind of had to think, geez, if that's what we're talking about, that's a big deal. And we're not preparing commensurate with that risk. You know, we knew that it was sort of a thing and this and that. But, boy, you know, seeing those images really brought that home. So my education began on December 27th, and that was basically beginning of 2005. And so since 2005, I've been doing a sort of self-guided graduate program on not only, and importantly, not so much, the physical process of plate tectonics and plates colliding and creating earthquakes and mountains, but so what for people, you mm-hmm. know? You know, my friends and family that live in the area, you know, they don't think about this, you know, 9 to 5 like I do. And so that really, really brought the focus to me of how important this catastrophic hazard is, how sort of underprepared we are for that, and trying to think through then how to convey the essential messages to folks. So that's been, you know, since about a 10-year effort on my part. And I think we've come an awful long way. Culturally, this is such an amazing thing in that this just fell in our lap in about 1990, the scientific consensus that, hey, you know, we get these things, what Chile got, what Japan got. Science is an interesting thing. You know, scientists explore, they come up with ideas of how the world works. They develop protocols and in science experiments and ways to explore to see if they can say something accurate about what they're looking at. And they say something, and other researchers go, that sounds kind of fishy, and they'll maybe do something to maybe challenge that, and egos do get involved, and papers are published, and there are these back and forths. And you know, through time, you know, science develops a consensus. Now, like I said earlier, my job is to convey that consensus to folks. Mm-hmm. Well, the consensus in the early 80s was we didn't get big earthquakes and tsunamis from this fault, based on the scientific reasoning at the time, which seemed to make sense at the time. Through time, the science has evolved, and importantly, you know, the 90s were a great year for Earth observation satellites and measuring devices, and the ability to poke and prod and look at and map, you know, the various physical landforms, you know, of the planet has really accelerated. Along with that has accelerated our understanding, like, geez, you know what? We really do get these buggers. And so...
And now we see the pattern going all the way back into the, you know, 1700 and even
beyond.
Before. Right.
Yes. Japan had a 1,000-year cultural history of earthquakes followed by tsunamis. And so everybody's grandmother over there was, you know, rah, 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 tsunami, tsunami. You know, Western settlement here happened relatively recently. And so we did not have the benefit of having that cultural indigenous knowledge, you know, here when we settled here. And so, you know, all of the sudden, you know, we're finding out, you know, not only do we get these, but we now have a 10,000-year core sample history, physical data from offshore canyons saying, hey, in the last 10,000 years, there have been, roughly 40 Cascadia events of a magnitude 8 or 9, and that pretty much defines a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake from all the other kinds. So Cascadia subduction zones are only bad ones. They're either 8s or 9s. There have been about 40 coastwide in the last 10,000 years. That's where you get that 250-year average occurrence interval. But there have been 19 magnitude 9s, which are the real big ones like Japan got. And so that's half of them were magnitude 9s. So we have quite a history, right as rain, right there in the core sample of, hey, guess what, folks in the Northwest? You know, you moved here and you didn't know about this, but that does not change the physical geology. You know, where do you think the mountains came from? Mm-hmm. And so now we're really, as a people, trying to wrap our head around what the scientific consensus now is. Mm-hmm. And we're not real good at that as human beings. You know, we like good news. you know, bad news isn't our favorite thing, especially bad news with the characteristics of this Cascadia thing.
Right.
Happen anytime. Could be real bad. If it happened right now, neither of us are with our families. Some of us are on different sides of bridges than the others. And, you know, things go real bad real quick when that happens. Kind of a hard thing for human beings to grok and to deal with.
Right. I mean, people will either go with, I don't even want to think about it. You know, blah, 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 I'm putting my fingers in my ears. Or they freak out and say, I'm never going to the beach again.
Correct. And so I think that's what normal people do. That's what smart people do. So I'm no smarter than I was in 2003. I've just learned about this particular phenomenon, and so I'm a little ahead on the learning curve. Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that. It reminds me, I jotted down some old think, new think notes to myself.
Great. Okay.
The old think was either, I don't think it will happen, or, oh, if it does happen, it's going to be so bad that I can't do anything about it. Mm. Well, the human mind is an interesting thing, and we're always looking for ways to not be responsible for stuff. Mm-hmm. And those two scenarios, either it won't happen, or if it does, it will be so bad we can't do anything, take away our power to do anything and to prepare. And so what we've learned, and Japan is the terrific example of that, is that you can prepare and you can affect evacuations. 90% of folks did get out of the way in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And so these do happen here. We have the physical evidence now. We also have the social evidence from other countries that have had more recent experience with this.
Mm-hmm.
And we've learned some important things on how to certainly improve your chances, if not ensure relative safety.
Mm-hmm.
So there are things we can do. We've identified some of those. And so now it's on us to sort of incorporate that information and move forward. And again, over time, keep plugging away, improving our effectiveness and improving our preparedness.
Okay, well, let's talk about what else we're doing here today, which is we're having a one-day pledge drive, a membership drive, to raise money for emergency preparedness. KMUN is a really important link in the community when we have a crisis. And as people who were here in 2007 during this very time might remember that KMUN was the only resource for information about where to go to get food, who was open, where there was a warm place to stay, what was happening, when there might be restored power, when the roads would be open, all that information. And of course, in an even worse disaster, that becomes even more important. I have a $300 goal for this program, which has about 20 minutes left, and I have a challenge grant. And the challenge grant is from Peak Marketing, and that means for every dollar that you donate, they'll donate a dollar up to $100. So that doubles during this time, that doubles your contribution, which is a great thing. I think in an emergency, one always needs good coffee. So we have lots of coffee here, and we have some really awesome stainless coffee mugs, and you can snap those up and take them home. And Patrick, tell us about some of the things that are emergency-related gifts that people can get.
Sure. So I came in the studio today, and there's all kinds of stuff laid out and decked out.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the cool things I found were a starter go bag. I've spoken about go bags, and that's just that essential stuff that you carry with you in your car and that kind of thing that, gee, I wish I had, And there's a starter go bag here, KMUN logo on the cover of the bag, a nifty little backpack-type bag, a bag with shoulder straps, with goodies inside there. And that's free for $25, so to speak, a donation for a good cause, and you get some free stuff.
Uh-huh.
You get to sport the KMUN logo backpack with all kinds of things inside, such as, from Providence Seaside Hospital, a first aid kit. There are some little shelter bags, flashlight, those kind of things that are typically in a starter go bag. A word on go bags, though, and I brought mine in today. I don't know if we have the courage to go through Pat's go bag or not. Maybe that's a different show. But the thing about go bags is, almost less what's in them and more that we've taken the time to think through the scenario that in which we would need a go bag. And let's just say it's a winter storm and I'm driving somewhere and there's downed trees and boom, a tree goes down behind me. Now I'm stuck for a little while. Not forever. It's not a catastrophe, but it's going to be uncomfortable for a while. Gee, what do I wish I had? So in my go bag, I have basic warm clothes and boots and hats and gloves and a nifty tarp. And by the way, for $100, there is a premium here, a hooded all-weather blanket. And I, as seen in Pat's go bag, it's a nice reflective material, and it has some cute little design features that are really nice. It's a basic tarp that's square, but in a couple of the corners there are little hand pouches, and so when you put this around you, your hands and your fingers really keep the thing taut, and you wrap it around you, and it's like this great big reflective blanket, and has a little pop-up hood even. So essentially a square tarp, but it has some neat custom features, so you can kind of hunker down and be as comfortable as you can if you find yourself in a sticky wicket. And so that is for a $100 pledge for that tarp.
Okay, do you also, when I'm in those situations, when I'm not prepared, I always wish I had something to eat. And there are so many things that are easy to pack that have good longevity. Because one of the things that happens is you pack your go bag, then you don't look at it for a year, and you go, ooh, I wonder if that granola bar is palatable. Of course, if you're hungry, it probably is.
Yes, palatable is a relative term, I think, depending on...
Cardboard could get palatable if you were really desperate.
Absolutely. But the odds are it will be a short term and overnight at most. And so, yeah, swap out some power bars or things. We can actually go off a long time. It's not comfortable, but it's not a dangerous situation to go a couple of days without food.
But the other thing would be, you know, some vacuum pack nuts.
Sure.
Would be a great thing. They will really sustain you. I mean, but what if you needed your go bag for something more? Like we were having a big event that you needed to get up. So I was at home, I grabbed my go bag, and I headed up to the column because that's the high place. Or up in the woods.
Are we talking about the earthquake and tsunami scenario?
Yes. Great. Yes.
Well, first of all, for most folks, certainly in a story, you don't need to go to the column.
Okay.
The elevation we need to get to, it varies all depending on how big the next event is.
Okay.
And so the most likely event next time, the column will be too high. And unnecessary evacuation can be a problem as well. You want to not go any farther than you need to. You'd probably, not sure where you live, but need to go to a neighbor up the hill a little bit. So bring your jammies.
No, I'm up the hill already. But what I'm thinking about is with a big shake, most of the houses in my neighborhood and all the power poles probably going to fall down. I need to get away from that stuff. I mean, what if there's gas fires? I mean, there's all, you know, our neighborhood is gasified. So I'm thinking I need to be, even though I'm up, there are a lot of potential dangers, such as my house coming down around me and my neighbor's house coming down the hill and all the other neighbor houses falling down and the power lines. So where should I go? I want to grab my bag and get out of there.
You need a jet pack.
Oh, I like that.
I grew up in the 60s and as a little kid and it was all about like Dick Tracy watches and jet packs were all with the future. Yeah. Well, we've got the Dick Tracy watches
practically,
the smart, but I'm waiting for the jet packs, you know?
Actually, I have seen jetpacks.
Cool.
But they're not widely available. Okay, so maybe I just go out in the street and just get away from buildings.
Yes. Yeah, so, well, first of all, let me reel you in a little bit because I think you're doing the natural human tendency for something we haven't experienced before, and that's to project the very worst case scenario on the next event.
Well, right, because I'm thinking about what do I need to have.
True, and it's always good to think about the worst case scenarios and kind of work back from there.
Mm-hmm.
With this earthquake and tsunami event, the odds of it being as bad as the worst ever are certainly not 100%. So the message I'd really like to convey to people is this is probably more likely than you think will happen, but the next event will probably be less bad than you think it will happen. So more likely, but less bad. So in that context, I would say take a breath and think about your house and... I would say if you're on the hill, the first strategy is to stay put and kind of see how things go.
Okay.
The next event will most likely be something where there's damage but not destruction. And so kind of reel that in a little bit.
Okay.
And I think you're thinking good, though, about if an event like this happens, where am I and what would I need? And that also factors into your go bag.
Okay.
And it's kind of like that mini little go bag is a subset of what you'd want if you were at home still.
Right. All right. You know, I didn't give the phone number, but we have a new guest. Hi, Terry Wilson, the engineer, is here. And he is, he's our emergency guy. How are you, Terry?
I'm doing fine.
Good.
The city took care of the streets yesterday, and they're thawing out very nicely.
Oh, good.
So no problem coming down the hill.
Oh, good.
By the way, I live at 314 feet. That's where my house is.
Terrific. And everybody thinks they're going to be sitting at home around the dinner table with their family. So that's great, Terry. Right now you're at about 90 feet. So you're still doing pretty darn good.
So is 90 feet okay?
So it all depends on how big the next earthquake is.
Okay.
And so that is something I think that's important for us to understand. Again, it goes to that the only scenario we can envision now that we're starting to believe it is the very worst case lights out scenario. We've had 40 of these things over the last 10,000 years. We're waiting for the 41st.
Mm-hmm.
The odds of the next one, that's the only one I really care about, is the next event.
Uh-huh.
And so when we look at statistical averages and this and that, you know, that's useful for scientific projection. Frankly, Pat Corcoran, I don't care about all that. I care about the next event and how my friends and neighbors are going to respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
The next event will most likely be something in the average range of earthquakes and tsunamis like we had in 1700. and that will be, you know, far less inundation than what our current evacuation brochures show. They show the worst case ever. So we've had 40. We mapped the worst case ever. And what I'm suggesting is there's still 39 that weren't as bad as that. And so the next one will probably be most likely something in the average range, which brings into play a whole lot more terrain all along the northern coast for sure.
Okay, so an average is what intensity?
Okay, different ways of measuring it. Let's just say an average would be maybe a 9.0. Last time, almost 15 years ago, January 26, 1700, the last known event was documented, and that's estimated to be about a 9.0. So pretty bad. It ripped all the way, you know, along the entire margin. But as far as these things go, it was kind of an average nine, if you can consider an average disaster.
Nine sounds bad.
It does sound bad, and it is bad, but it's not as bad as a 9.5, and that's what the maps are generated around. So,
okay. We have some news?
Oh, we'd like to thank Jerome and Jan from Cannon Beach and Chris from Astoria.
Yay.
And while I've got the microphone, I want to thank our esteemed guest here, because you have taught me something that I now start talking about all the time.
Uh-oh.
Situational awareness. Oh. I keep talking about, well, I'm, you know, I'll hear, well, I live in a high altitude. I says, what if you're at Fred Meyer? What if you're at Costco?
Yeah.
What if you're driving across the bridge
and
all of a sudden it happens and you can't get back across the bridge? Now that we got the two bridges over in Young's Bay, they're out of commission for repair. Maintenance, and what if the big bridge comes down? What are you going to do? Where are you going to go? Always look around. This is what you taught me, Pat. Always look around. Where can I go if it really hits the fan?
And right. The time to have those sort of internal, is that why your lips move when I see you driving around in the car? The time to have those conversations is before it happens.
Absolutely.
And the time to have conversations with your kids and your family members is before it happens.
Absolutely. All right, we had a caller who wanted us, who had a food idea, and they suggested a small case of extra lean Spam in your go bag, a small case. They said the extra lean will last forever. Of course, that is suspect. But it has a pop-up, no can opener needed. So it has some benefits. So there's a suggestion. I'd like to give the phone number, because I did forget to give it. We'd love you to call to help me meet my $300 pledge goal and to make Peak Marketing have to come good on their $100 challenge and double your contribution. So the number is 503-325-0010.
Or 1-800-518-0010.
And call right now. It just takes a second. Cindy Price is out there, our new Astoria City Councilor, answering the phone. You can give her hell about anything you like. Tell her how bad the city is managing something. She's brand new. I'm sure she'll be full of...
But do call. I remember maybe 2 years ago we did this as well, and we got so involved in our doom and gloom conversations, we raised like 50 cents over the course of the whole thing. And so today I came in and I asked, so this is a pledge drive mini for fundraising for emergencies. And
right.
So I was asking, okay, so what is the need, you know, for KMUN? And she was telling me about the propane tanks, which we've been hearing about today. So fill the tank.
Right.
But also fix the tank. Apparently, Terry, I'm sure you can address the switch or something that's a manual switch.
Well,
now,
about 3 weeks ago, all of a sudden, KMUN, our big transmitter at 5,300 watts, went off the air. And we ran up there and found out a very important piece of equipment that allows our signal to get from Tilcombe House in downtown Astoria up to the top of the mountain. It's called an STL, a studio to transmitter link. The receiver up there went bad. And so Ray and I were up there, and I diagnosed it as a power supply. And we called the manufacturer, and when I called and told him what it was, he says, oh, that's old. And he muttered around and he says, well, we'll charge you $2,400 to repair it. And I says, you don't even know what's wrong with it. He says, if we can repair it, it'll be $2,400. And so I said, okay, thank you much. And I called our consulting engineer, Gray Hartig, in Portland, and he says, send it to me. Now, the power supply alone was 742, something like that. And I sent it up to him, and he says, yes, you're right. The power supply is bad. I found one on the internet, $74.
So you guys are spending these dollars wisely on things, I can tell. Good for you for
but
that.
But it brings up a point that the equipment is old. And sitting in front of an audio board, that we call it, that controls all the microphones and all the playing machines. And it is old. Each switch costs $25. The light bulbs cost $7, you
really?
Know. And pretty soon...
Oh, man, there are hundreds of light bulbs on this.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And someday we're not going to be able to get parts for them.
Right.
We'll and I've run into this also. A good machine that you use all the time is so you can record guests from their telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the one in our other control room is bad, and I can't get it repaired.
Oh, is that why we're having trouble?
However, I found a brand new one for like $350.
Oh.
But we need the $350 to replace it, so Ann can talk to somebody in Afghanistan.
That's right. who's doing something amazing that we all want to know about. Yeah, that's true. I have interviewed people in the Andes and in New York and all over the place. And yeah, and without the phone, I can't do it.
And the phone numbers are 503-325-0010 or 1-800-518-0010.
And, you know, your contribution makes a difference at any amount. It really doesn't matter. I mean, if you could do a dollar a day, we would love it. But if you can do $25 a year, we love that just as much.
Every penny helps.
Absolutely. And, you know, to buy a $350 part doesn't take, you know, that's a pretty easy nut. But the $2,400, that's a lot harder.
Yeah.
Or when a tree hits the roof of the building and we have to, if we had to have completely redone the roof, anyone who owns a home knows a roof is a very expensive thing to do.
And just like a home, this is a home. This is a beautiful wood structure. And like everybody else's home, it needs maintenance and repair.
Absolutely.
And today, anticipating an event that we need to respond to. And so this is real important to kind of get this, fill that tank, fix that tank.
Right,
and
get everything up to snuff so that if we have something, or we might have multiple somethings this winter, everything from trees down on the road to slides to, you know, bigger things, we need to be there to be the voice of, don't go on this road, you know, go here. If you need food, it's over there, or whatever it is.
And even in addition to the factual information that comes across the air, I remember in the 2007 storm, just turning on the radio just for companionship.
Absolutely.
And just to hear that other people, how are they doing, and just to get a sense of community. And the research post-disaster, that people are really hungry for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is important to have a station up and running, even especially during the tough times.
Absolutely. That really reminded me of how the radio was so important to connect with the rest of the world. And KMUN was it.
And so things that are especially useful in Japan are like a low-power FM radio and things like that, kind of low-tech. So,
right,
so
and
good.
Then having batteries and refreshing them. Oh, good morning. Guys. Joanne is here. Oh, wait, everyone's shifting.
I'll get a new mic. I'll get another mic.
Hi, Susan. Okay, thank you, John, in Astoria, and Jackie, who's a new member. Oh, we especially love new members.
Thanks, Jackie.
So we've been joined by our station manager, Joanne Rideout.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for coming in.
Oh, my gosh. Well, of course, I couldn't resist climbing into the air room here with this crew, Pat and Terry and you.
Yeah, this is fun.
This is the emergency services, you know, ground zero here.
We've got more go bags per capita in this room than anywhere on the county.
That's right. Well, I'm really inspired to keep working on my go bags. I have one in the car. We have one in each car, and then there's one by the door. But they need to be filled out. They need more stuff. Okay, what about the water deal?
Look, we live in a place that has lots of water. I mean, I have a little water purifier in my go bag. But, you know, things like water, please don't put 50 pounds of water in your backpack and try to...
Lug it up the hill.
Yeah, so we have plenty of water. Just think it through. A little thing of purification pills would do just fine.
Oh, that's nice and light.
We have 40 gallons of potable water in our hot water heaters in our homes. So, you know, when we think it through, there's actually a lot of water out there.
Yeah, okay.
Most importantly is cover and warm things.
Okay.